Thank you all for coming, and I guess we'll get started with the Lincoln Observatory's second seminar of this academic year. And it's the second, isn't it? I think it's the second. And we're very pleased to have Dr. Emilia Giorgio from the Department of Media and Communications. And Miria is associate professor in that department, but she is a sociologist by training. She has a PhD from the sociology department here at the LSE. And she also has much experience as a journalist, working for the BBC World Service, Greek Press, the Cyprus Broadcasting Corporation as well. And her research for many years now has focused on media in the city, urban technologies and politics of connection, and the ways in which migration and diaspora are politically, culturally, and morally constituted. She's the author of a couple of very interesting books, Media and the City, Cosmopolitanism and Difference, which came out in 2013, and Diaspora Identity in the Media, Transnationalism and Mediated Spatialities, which came out in 2006. And today she'll be talking about communication architecture of the border, constructions of Europe's humanitarian securitization. And we'll say 40 to 45 minutes, that's okay. Mm-hmm. So we have time for discussion. And I'll give you a signal.
Yes.
About 5 minutes, please. Okay.
Thank you so much for the invite. It's great to be here and seeing some familiar and new faces. I'm talking here about a recently completed research conducted in Greece in the midst of the and at the peak of the so-called refugee crisis. So I'm presenting work which is currently being worked in a paper and work that I have been empirical research and work that I have been conducting with my colleague Lili Hoularagi. So I was thinking about where we are now and where we started. And I'm thinking that a year is a very long time in politics, and this includes humanitarian politics in Europe. Only about a year ago, Europe was taken aback by that moment of ecstatic humanitarianism. The days, weeks, and perhaps a couple of months after the publication of the photo, the iconic and tragic photo of Alan Kurdi, the boy who we saw across the world lying dead at the seashore after his family's tragic and failed journey to Europe, did take Europe by the heart, we could say, at that moment of ecstatic humanitarianism. A year later, Europe is in a very different place. And Europe is now deep into a politics of securitization and border control. This politics was almost fully replaced by that politics almost fully replaced that warm moment of reception, welcoming of those in need, at least a conditional moment of welcoming those in need. In this paper, I want to take us back to that different time and space and discuss the politics of reception at Europe's and Greece's borders, at the moment when the border was conditionally open. With reference to the communication architecture of the border, which makes the politics of reception possible, I want to try to show that the current regime of securitization was the inevitable endpoint to the so-called refugee crisis. This is the case, as I will argue, that even at that moment of ecstatic humanitarianism last autumn and winter, humanitarianism was always conditioned to the politics of security. The newcomers, as the literature on humanitarian securitization and critical migration studies would argue, were then and they are now subject to a politics that reaffirms their otherness and their place as Europe's unknown and possibly threatening others. Recording this regime of power at the border, I also want to raise two questions. Is humanitarian securitization as rigid as the literature has it? And is it possible to even consider the possibility of Europe as a space of hospitality within that context of humanitarian securitization? Humanitarian securitization is not unique to Greece or Europe, but is also a dominant practice in various conflict zones and reception points for refugees. And it reflects, according to the literature, again, primarily in critical migration and border studies, it reflects the fusion of two competing ethico-political requirements. On the one hand, to secure borders and the lives of those inside a certain community, but on the other, to provide care to those in need, and to provide care independently of who those in need are or where they come from. The main criticism around humanitarian securitization is that within this regime, what is happening is a disguise of the exercise of sovereign power, of who is allowed in and out in the name of good doing. Within it, within humanitarian securitization, certain people deserve care, certain people are allowed or are guaranteed safe passage, but certain people also have the right to citizenship, while others will never do. And while this is a regime that goes much further away in scale, time, and space than what I will be arguing today, it goes across national, regional, and global politics that relate to border control and humanitarian crisis management. The border of Europe, and in recent months, of course, and years, the border of Greece in particular, has become a testing ground for the contested politics of security and care. If we're talking about Europe, and before we start thinking about humanitarian securitization becoming the dominant regime of control and surveillance of newcomers' bodies and their mobility across Europe, we can see this ambivalent regime rehearsed and validated at the border and at the point of the initial contact with refugees and migrants. At that moment in time, when the foreign bodies enter Europe and its physical space, the double but inevitable contradictory requirement of care and protection are put to the test. And it is, in fact, the communicative architecture of this double requirement that we have recorded in our study at the Greek island of Chios, how reception and the possibility of hospitality are constituted at the physical and symbolic space of the border, where the distant other becomes physically proximate. My colleague Lili Hoularaki and I landed at the island of Chios in December 2015 and in the midst of the large waves of refugee arrivals at the Greek shores. At the time, Europe was conditionally opening its borders, at least to some of those fleeing conflict. And Chios, as one of the islands, as I suspect most of you know, as one of the islands most proximate to the Turkish shores, was one of the main gateways. Most people fleeing war and prosecution, those arriving in dinghies in the island on a daily basis, reached at times 1,600 and 1,700 women, men, and children. At the shore and inside Europe's border, a number of actors were receiving the new arrivals, representing the different nodes of the structure of reception that made hospitality a possibility, but also at times an impossibility. So this possibility or impossibility of hospitality was at the heart of our 10-year intense fieldwork. And some people wonder how we did that. We worked long shifts. It was really intense. So it was a 10-year intense fieldwork that included ethnographic observations, interviews, semi-structured and unstructured interviews with about 30 actors of the border. I here want to share the complex story we recorded within the framework of what we call communicative architecture of the border, the architecture that supports, shapes, and occasionally challenges the border's powerful regime of humanitarian securitization. This architecture, we argue, includes three different spaces of reception, what we refer to as military securitization, caring securitization, and compassionate solidarity. And you can see there on the slide who are the main actors in these different spaces. Across these three spaces of practice, we looked into the three key networks of media technologies and practices that constitute and sustain the structures of humanitarian securitization. And I will be referring to those across the paper and as I will discuss the different spaces of reception. So we'll be referring to remediation as that space and the relationships between actors of reception and the mainstream media. Intermediation is the connection of those actors within and across digital media. And transmediation is the relationship between actions that take place on the online and the offline world. So let me first go to the most formal and rigid space of reception that you can see recorded in one of the very few photos that have made it out of the island, the main site of military securitization. So in our paper, we refer to military securitization as the media context that makes the border a context of identification, classification, and control of mobile populations. On Hughes in December 2015, this context consisted of 13 Greek police and army officers and also 7 Frontex personnel, the European police, all of them coming from Holland. The main site of operation of military securitization was the registration center that you can see here. This was a place where migrants had to go through passport control, debriefing, and digital identification. The process that decided whether they would continue their journey towards Northern Europe, which at the time was the case for Syrian, Afghani, and Iraqi, or to remain on the island until their prospective deportation. There are two things to note in the context of military securitization. First, and even though the island saw hundreds of people arriving at its shores, the military officers were limited at numbers. So the first point where newcomers would encounter the security forces tended to be the registration center here. Operational gaps were filled by NGOs and local volunteers who were more likely to be seen at the coast where the dinghies arrived. Secondly, the registration center, as you can see, was anything but that center of reception or is what you would expect as a center of registration. Rather, it was an abandoned factory with asbestos that caused various trouble between the personnel working there, NGOs and military personnel, and which had a number of smashed windows, no proper heating or lighting. Yet within that context, registration moved surprisingly smoothly. And as the local police chief, a young Greek man, explained to us, this happened because his men were driven by a sense of patriotic duty and professional commitment, but they were also compassionate. So, as he said, we cannot let those poor people and their small children wait for days. And then he added, like they do in Lesbos, just to make a point. This effective performance, however, needs to be contextualized within the wider frame of the Greek crisis, so economic crisis. So all this, of course, takes place in the midst of the Greek economic crisis. Greek officers felt let down by the state, but they felt let down by the EU as well. So military securitization became a local affair. Local officers had no support from the center, and actually both the factory and the computers they used for registration were acquired through personal acquaintances of the local police officers. Military securitization was also based on an internal hierarchy between the Greek officers and Frontex. So while Frontex were working on an 8-hour shift, the Greeks were working on 12 and 18-hour shifts, and their salaries were 8 times less than those of Frontex. So within this environment, what are the media practices and discourses of military securitization? The registration process is invisible in the mainstream media, for obvious security reasons, of course. But the context and the practices that take place in military securitization are hidden from the public. media reports, and any appearance of the registration centres in the media would usually be contained within ceremonial snapshots or statements, snapshots of visiting politicians outside rather than inside the centre. So importantly, military securitization is invisible securitization. The core securitization activities in registration, though, relies on intermediation, and especially the Eurodac system. This is the digital technology that links that abandoned factory to the global digital archives of biometrical information and offers confidential information on the identity of every new arrival. Critical security studies theorize Eurodact as the biopolitical practice, what Salter would call the use of bodies as instruments of power in the politics of mobility, and classified legal or illegal, classified people as legal or illegal. So, moving from the digital to the physical space, what we saw was that together with the use of digital identification, military securitization also relied on face-to-face communication. In debriefings, faces and body language were used as media for the extraction of meanings of the newcomer's intentions and their authenticity. Officers would use the bodies and the faces of the new arrivals to read signs of their sincerity or inauthenticity and to classify them accordingly. They would often rely on body language to identify the migrant's country of origin. For example, some of the officers told us that they can say who's an Afghani just by the way they sit, or they would say that Syrians are well-dressed and they're people like us. So this is interesting for us because at the time of globalized surveillance system and digital ID technology, in the military securitization of Europe's border, it appears that the physical bodies continue to be profoundly important. So in the border, the bodies worked as intimate systems of biopolitics. They were sites for the exercise of power through their classification as legitimate or illegitimate bodies. So, also interestingly, vis-à-vis or against the security forces' agentive use of cultural knowledge, including stereotypes, of course, what we saw also was a similar use, agentive use of bodies by the migrants themselves. So from a very unequal position, of course, the newcomers knew and understood these politics of sorting bodies and intentions. And from their positions, they themselves mobilize their agency in trying to perform in that role of the refugee, what they thought, or probably quite rightly understood, was what was expected from the genuine refugee, emphasizing a Syrian origin, either they were Syrian or not, or giving the very sad story that the police, the border police, expects to hear. So refugees and migrants also drew upon those discourses of security in trying to claim their passage to Europe. To sum up, in relation to that space of the politics of the border, military securitization relied on a communication network that combined the invisibility of the public the invisibility from the public of securitization, as the exposure to both mass media and social media was strictly forbidden, with digital practices of biometric governance that guaranteed the security prerogative, as well as the use of bodies as media to make sorting possible between those worthy of passage and those deemed unworthy or even dangerous. Alongside the military securitization exist two domains of care, what we refer to as caring securitization and compassionate solidarity. We refer to caring securitization as the institutionalized domain of support mechanism for refugees and migrants offered by a number of national and international agencies that were in the island, dozens of them, with the largest one of them and the one in charge being the UNHCR. These organizations are the one with a mandate to provide humanitarian assistance and human rights advocacy, So their role is supposed to be rather distinct or oppositional to those of the security forces. However, at reception, at Europe's reception point, the daily work of the humanitarian organization was closely associated with the security forces, managing refugees, and sometimes even being called in to manage trouble or conflict between refugees and migrants. The contradictions and even the personal anxieties and struggles associated with NGO staff predicament, who were caught very much between that double requirement of care and security, was captured repeatedly in our observations and interviews. Some would accept that their engagement with refugees was inevitably procedural, as their priority was to meet the needs of many people urgently. As a day-to-day practice, what that means was that the encounters between humanitarians and newcomers was very limited and contained within the offer of a nutrition bar or the UNHCR iconic grey blanket, as well, at the same time, as ensuring that every arrival has been given a bracelet, a different but perhaps similar to the security forces system of identification, where newcomers were categorized based on the day of their arrival, the day they were expected to leave, and what kind of provisions they have received. Yet also some struggled with the securitization of care, as we can see in this quotation by the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. So what are the communication structures within that regime of caring securitization? The humanitarian organizations are exactly at this opposite position to that of military securitization. They're the actors of the border that we see most visibly in the mass media, in the mainstream media. Official statements by UNHCR or calls for public support or critique by different actors have brought again and again, and do bring still, those actors of bordering in the attention of the public, of the local, national, and transnational public. At the same time, their use of digital media is surprisingly contradictory. So while we see within the diverse space of humanitarianism, we see the use of digital media extensively for internal communication. We see that this internal communication is vibrant, but of course it's also hierarchical, so certain actors have more of a say than others, and very often the communication goes from top, the biggest organizations, to the bottom, the smaller organizations, and the local organizations. But most strikingly, what we thought it was most striking was that digital communication was hardly ever used in the communication of the humanitarians and the newcomers, the refugees and migrants. So for NGOs, pre-digital media, such as posters and pamphlets, were usually deemed as more useful than digital communications to communicate in posters, offer of clothing, or when the next boat leaves. And this was an interesting choice, especially since an estimated 80% of the migrants had smartphones. The transmediation of securitized care similarly had a dual form. First, the use of online platforms was used extensively to update NGO offline action. For instance, late arrivals of dinghies would give rise to a vast exchange of messages on WhatsApp and other platforms and get everybody on their feet. Secondly, the pre-electronic technologies coordinated the mobility of migrants on the island. So the migrants, those arriving, would be coordinated with the non-digital, non-interactive technologies. To sum up on caring securitization, even though caring securitization's mediation networks are allowed for a range of relevant voices to be heard, its structure was ultimately highly hierarchical, and we could say at times unidirectional. The major actors of caring securitization perpetuated unidirectional top-down channels of communication with all others but themselves. And in this structure, unsurprisingly, migrants and refugees were fully silenced. The third space of our study was that of compassionate solidarity. And you can see pictures from one of those sites where this is compassionate solidarity is performed. Almost all refugees and migrants landed to the island after a dangerous journey. The images on our screens that travel across Europe, and they were traveling at the time across Europe, do not always capture the state of their arrival, soaked to the bone with the children being frightened and the old ones, the grown-ups, being cold, tired, but relieved with the temporal end of their journey. What also mediated images do not always capture is the predominance of the non-professional, non-institutional sector of care and reception at the points of arrival, what we refer to as the networks of compassionate solidarity. Where securitized care, for example, offered a nutrition bar, the network of compassionate solidarity offered warm food, as did the so-called collective kitchen, a solidarity network of people who would go and cook warm meals for new arrivals in the breaks between their work. And sometimes they were cooking up to 1,600 portions of food a day. And we were happy to help in that process for a couple of days. Where securitized care guaranteed access to dry clothing within 12 hours of arrival, the residents of the fishing village Agia Hermione, which you can see here, offered arrivals clothing, biscuits, and milk as they came out of the sea. The dinghies arriving at the shore of Agia Hermione day in, day out, were always received by the mostly pensioner villagers who sometimes worked in a 16-hour, 18-hour shift receiving new arrivals, because at times there was one boat after the other arriving in that little village. Driven by progressive politics of solidarity, which was operationalized through informal and emotionally charged acts of support towards newcomers, the networks of compassionate solidarity were rather different in their constitution and values to those of security forces as well as the NGOs. The discourse of humanity was what predominated and was expressed in explicit references to the activist affective identification with migrants, something that was very different to the words very often of the humanitarian sector and the humanitarian personnel. So here it was clear. It's obvious why we help them. They could have been us. What are the networks and discourses of mediation that communicate and organize compassionate solidarity here? The mass media, again, in opposition to the formal sector of care, the mass media had literary interest to the acts of these networks. But respectively, activists did not seek mass media's attention. On the contrary, they were very wary of them, and they were happy to stay away from mainstream media. In fact, their engagement with digital media, as I will explain in a second, was itself a contestation of mainstream media authority. Intermediation is very systematic for the networks of compassionate solidarity, and this worked as an empowering system of civic voices in interpersonal networks of exchange of communication in relation to the network's activities, and on social media and civic journalism sites, where we saw stories produced by the activists and shared with local audiences and other members of the wider network of solidarity. Digital media is where messages of protest as well as solidarity are circulated and shared. Most encounters, of course, among activists and between activists, refugees, and migrants were face-to-face and offline, and enacted through collective action, such as meal distribution, provision of dry clothes at the shore, but protest as well outside the hotspot and outside the registration center. Yet the physicality of care solidarity was both managed and regulated through a feedback loop that linked the digital to the physical, for example, through social media calls for action, or reports of activity that was taking place on the action that gave a system of accountability to the activists as they shared their action online, but also, and very importantly, in a very invisible and important way, a lot of the social activity among the activists was organized online and on social networks. And these kind of social activities, which did not directly translate into acts of solidarity, was very critical for those activists to decompress and to manage regular encounters of trauma. Many of them actually suffered, acquired various health problems as a result of their acts of solidarity. Compassionate Solidarity's network of mediation articulated a complex discourse of care. This was defined by a spirit of resistance to the power of the border and the structures of securitization. So this is where humanitarian securitization and its politics directly challenged. However, the discourse of compassionate solidarity are neither pure nor unaffected from securitization. Despite stark opposition to it, the discourses associated with securitization and processes of othering still functioned within the wider regime of bordering that classifies newcomers and their needs from an uneven position of privilege as European citizens. Also, in occasions, volunteers and activists criticize some newcomers for their eating habits, for their manners, or for their gender roles, mobilizing in that way mechanisms of othering that separate us from them and which privilege a view of humanity that is primarily or exclusively our own humanity. Such familiar narratives represented these people's attempts to make sense of those new strangers from within the familiar cultural frameworks that they function in the discourses of the border, of Europe of the border, and of Greece of 2015 and before. At the same time, volunteers and activists were painfully aware of the ambivalent and powerful role of the border and their place in that regime of the border as well. On the one hand, many of them were aware that this is a place for deciding newcomers' future through processes of digital identification as refugees or asylum seekers or as illegal immigrants. On the other, this was a transient moment of brief encounters, and that brief encounter itself, they knew that dehumanized newcomers further, and volunteers felt that they were taking part in this dehumanizing process. And as one of them says here, I think poignantly, and tragically, I'd say, from the position where these people function, we used to know them, referring to the refugees. Now we don't anymore. They all have become one. The voice of the people has been lost, and the political work to this direction is also lost, as we're just trying to meet the needs.
Who said that?
One of the activists.
Local?
Local. All these people are local. Yes, all these people are local, we're talking about here. And we can read that also in the context of pressure that these local non-professionals felt in the context of a non-existent state, where actually their activists had to be content with meeting very basic needs that elsewhere or in other contexts would be met by a formal institutional state-run system. So to sum up, compassionate solidarity offers the clearest manifestation of the border as a space of hospitality. Compassionate Solidarity's network's use of social media platforms and online journalism coordinated a considerable amount of extremely effective action. So when UNHCR declared very early on that they cannot provide hot food, these people managed to provide hot food, again, as I said, you know, which they prepared in the middle of their working day. Simultaneously, though, contact with newcomers remained minimal and fragmentary, and the latter were given no voice in this process. this contradiction constitutes a major existentialist challenge for those involved in practices of compassionate solidarity, perhaps as we can see here. This was a contradiction that compelled them to engage in a constant negotiation of opposing affective states: compassion and guilt, dedication and powerlessness, sadness and indignation, hope and despair. In coming to the end of this presentation and to conclude, let me revisit the questions I said as I introduced Hios and our fieldwork on the island. So is the regime of humanitarian securitization a rigid system of control of bodies and of actions of different actors in the refugee crisis? Is there any possibility for an ethics of hospitality at the border of Europe? Or even is there a possibility to think of Europe as a space that is welcoming and which can integrate newcomers who are now in our midst, the newcomers who settle in Europe? We certainly see some of this in our fieldwork in Hios. The communicative architecture of the border largely functions to reaffirm newcomers' otherness and their position as recipients of decisions made without their own involvement, made without their own voice. Yet, and while Greece and Europe's border confirms the dominant regime of humanitarian securitization, our study at the border also reveals a more complex, more dynamic and incomplete story. On the one hand, humanitarian securitization, that rather than purely a matter of surveillance and control, appears as a regime of various technologies and competing narratives, competing emotions, relationships, which also have their internal hierarchies. Two things to highlight here. First, the politics of reception was largely controlled through digital technologies, especially the technologies of surveillance, and this is even more the case now than it was then. However, alongside this powerful role of digital technologies, all actors of the border mobilized, even if importantly in different ways. They all mobilized systems of cultural knowledge and used their face-to-face encounters with newcomers to make sense of them. Second, the way in which voices and narratives of the border combined and appeared in various media, both mainstream and digital, reflected internal hierarchies of the border, but also their momentary ruptures in their relationships between different elements of the border security forces, the tensions that were clear between the Greek personnel of the border and Frontex, between different humanitarian organizations and the tensions that related to the internal hierarchies, but also between activists and refugees and those moments of anxiety or demand for a more dialogical loop of information and exchange. What does this say about the possibility or the impossibility of hospitality? Against analysis of hospitality that opposes it to security structures, we argue that what happens in the border is a development of what we call a regime of hospitability. We borrow hospitability as a concept from military technology studies. According to that scholarship, hospitability is a technological space, red on radar interfaces, that encloses military moving targets. It allows those targets some scope of maneuvering within delimited boundaries, but forbids any movement outside the scope. It is a space of strictly conditional agency. Hospitability, we argue, can be aptly captured in the practice of European border and the politics of its bordering. To encompass refugees and migrants, allowing them various degrees of mobility in Europe, but always under very strict conditions. The moral order of hospitability resides in this hybrid capacity, suspended as it is, between controlling an enclosure and enabling mobility, perhaps in the same way that we have that fragile hybridity between the politics of security and the politics of care. So hospitability represents a regime of bordering that reaffirms transnational hierarchies at that moment of entry humanitarian securitization is not only tested, but is also established. So it reaffirms transnational hierarchies while embracing, though, at the same time, and at least momentarily, at least at the margin of the regime of reception, an ethics of hospitality, empathy, and solidarity, which, at the same time as transnational hierarchies, is produced through the act of bordering itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Miria. I really enjoyed that, and I'm sure it will have stimulated a lot of questions for the audience. I'm going to take my role as chair to start out and ask you a couple of things. What I'm going to ask is, I've been trying to think about how to link it to the notion of hospitability, and I have a vague idea of how to do that, but I'm still working it out. But I wanted to ask you first something about what you said to me before your talk about the need to historicize, right? And I wondered if you might say something about that, in that, of course, Chios received so many displaced persons from what's now Turkey, and I wonder what the role of historical consciousness is there, and also the role of a consciousness of Turkey as being at the border. In other words, how does that play into the way that hospitality or hospitability is perceived here? And in relation to that, but in a slightly different vein, I had the opportunity to chair another session in the spring held here, organized by the Greek Students Association on the refugee crisis, and they had invited the mayor of Chios. And it was very interesting that he also complained about the non-existent state, even though, of course, you could consider him to be, you know, a member of that same body. And I just wondered about how the border looks, how the border itself looks when the state starts to recede. In other words, do you see some change in the way that people perceive the concept of the border when so many people, even state officials, can perceive there to be a receding state? I don't know if you want to address that, or if you'd like me to take some more questions.
It's up to you.
Okay. Well, why don't we take a couple more? Okay. And I'd ask you to say your names and your affiliations, if you wouldn't mind, first. Let me take you first.
So, hi, everyone. My name is Sira. I'm a PhD student at the European Institute. I wanted to focus on military securitization and to ask you if it would be possible to talk about degrees of military securitization, and if so, where you would place Chios in such a spectrum. And the reason why I'm asking is because I was struck by the number of police and frontex personnel that you talked about. Actually, it's a very small number. I mean, the hotspot in Chios is a facility that hosts over 1,000 migrants. And to have 14 police officers for such a number of people, to me, is actually evidence of very low security. And actually, perhaps it is contrary to the duty of care towards these people, because if something happens among them, there is nobody there to intervene. And then on biometric identification, yes, it is an evidence of securitization, but it's actually quite basic, because if you don't identify biometrically, don't fingerprint persons entering the territory legally, then, you know, how do you control a border? I mean, it's the most basic element of policy that comes with actually having a border that is controlled, monitored. And lastly, while I agree with you and I see the picture and the factory of hotspot looks very unwelcoming and is very unwelcoming. On the other hand, there is also a reception facility in Viala, which is one of the best in the country by now, with the containers which have individual toilets and individual air conditions. I mean, and the facility itself is open. People can go in and out freely. Nobody controls who goes in and out. And has been open for almost the entire time of its existence, apart from a small period perhaps after the Turkey deal. So I'm wondering, in this context, can we talk about the securitization that's not actually as high as it could have been?
Okay.
I'm an economist, so when you ask slightly different questions. But I want to ask about hospitality, because there are pretty large numbers of people. Can you actually describe what the humanitarian organizations did? You said that they were handing out people, I think you said nutrition bars, that there were, I don't know, sort of several thousand refugees on site any one day. Presumably they had to eat rather more than a nutrition bar a day, and there were people who were cooking meals for them, and there were quite a lot of people probably cooking the meals, and there was quite a lot of meals that had to be prepared to feed these people. So the first thing which intrigued me was who was actually paying for all this, because hospitality actually requires resources. And was it the case that these activities were somehow paid for by somebody else but subcontracted to volunteers in local civil society with the assumption that these people would somehow do something and that we could rely upon their feelings of humanity to do something? And then when I think about hospitality, I also think about fatigue. It's all very well having your friends coming on visit, but at a certain time you also get a bit fed up with your friends on visit and you hope that they will go away. Now, this didn't happen there, because even if person A went away, person B arrived the next day. So you were actually being required to be hospitable for a very long period, and an awful lot appeared to be required of you, whether it was your labour, whether it was your empathy, and whether, which I still don't know, whether it was actually your money and resources who were actually feeding them.
Let you answer those. We take a few more.
Okay, thank you very much. I mean, some really important questions and comments. So I'll just answer as the questions came in. Historical consciousness, absolutely. One of the reasons we decided to focus on the last network, the networks of solidarity, which is exclusively local, even though there were other networks of solidarity which were not local, was largely the result of this record of a very widely shared historical memory and a historical consciousness of what it means to be a refugee at the border, at a place which has been experienced throughout its history, the flows of people fleeing war, conflict, famine, and so on, and going to both directions of the border. So we were actually impressed how people of all ages will turn to that discourse. And a reason that I put that quote up, that could be us. Mm-hmm. You know, we help them because that could be us. It was very often accompanied by, well, my grandparents, or, you know, we've seen all the refugees. We were refugees, you know, once, referring, of course, to not to themselves, but, you know, to older generations. So that collective memory was striking. And I think that leads partly to the question about military securitization, and partly answers your question about how the border looks when the state recedes. Mm-hmm. In many ways, what we recorded, and partly that answers, I think, your question, was that transient moment. So you have a security or a humanitarian crisis over the whole of Europe being handled by a 30-year-old local police officer and all his friends who can lend him computers so he can do the biometrical registration and so on. So where this historical memory was most striking, we thought, was in that side of the security personnel and the border police, that a lot of the ambivalence that we observed in the acts and the discourses shared by the military personnel, we feel that reflected that collective memory. So in many ways, you know, they had to do a very formal, expected, required, inevitable work that you do as border police. But at the same time, these people would also say, well, you know, refugees, we know what it means to be refugee. So that partly was you know, that ambivalence that we thought that slightly gave us the, that impression of that moment of humanizing a very dehumanizing space and experience for thousands of people had to do partly with the lack of the state. Mm-hmm. Of course, the downside of that is that on the one hand we had overworked security forces, perhaps with not all the instruments that they needed to do that proper work of the border, but also what we had were people who were volunteers and who developed heart problems, depression, who had problems with their work because they were not working and they were cooking food. The trauma and the and those kind of the fatigue that ended up, you know, in cases being expressed as trauma, mm-hmm. was also something that was largely the part of not having a state. Mm-hmm. If that answers mm-hmm. your question. Mm-hmm. Military securitization. Yes, again, because that was a transient moment, the security forces were hugely understaffed. As we left the island, a new force of about 40 Frontex was coming in, and they would take over, again, you know, redefining who is in control of the border, and they would take over, and it was that crucial moment also that, you know, the border is not anymore the border of Greece, it's the border of Europe, and Frontex would fully take control. So it was a transient moment, and of course the degrees of militarization increased, and now they're in their extreme. Biometrics, yes, it's inevitable, is part of, you know, the security of a country or Europe. But I think what's interesting and important for us is the politics that surround this biometrical registration, how people are being categorized. And very often they're being categorized based not on the necessity of information, but based on bigger politics. And just to explain what I mean, when I was in Chios in December, Iraqis were refugees, and they were recorded as refugees. When I went to Lesbos in February, Iraqis were illegal immigrants, and they were recorded as illegal immigrants. So it's this politics of naming and classifying that is important, because, yes, digital information in itself can be relevant in different ways. Chios is the best example. Yes, I think the people there, and you know, the mayor, at least for a while, everybody was very proud for being the best case of a welcoming island. This has changed a lot since, and partly it changed because it's not an open space anymore, and Vial is not, I would completely disagree with you, it's not best practice. Their protest and riots in Vial, people have been eating the same food, boiled potatoes, for months, which has been subcontracted to a local company who, of course, don't care what they feed people, and people do not have free mobility, and they are the numbers are that stay in the hotspot are much larger than the numbers that the hotspot has been created for. So I think we have a different perspective to that. Hospitality, who pays for this? I think that, of course, would have been a whole different paper and a whole book, I think. It's very, very interesting, the economics, I think, of hospitality and reception. Obviously, I'm not an expert. Obviously, we didn't do much on this. But what we saw when we went there was that there's a lot of money put in the humanitarian care. So the numbers of organizations and the fact that a few hundreds of them were staying for months in four-star hotels, you know, in itself, you know, shows you that that there is a lot of money put in humanitarian care. However, I think partly like the biometrical recording, the politics sometimes of care are different to the economics of care. So the fact that we were very surprised that UNHCR, which had a few hundreds of people working for them, coming from elsewhere, but also local. UNHCR, the only food that they could provide was one nutrition bar a day. So this seemed to us that it was more of a priority of how to spend the money or how not to spend the money, rather than, you know, how much money.
I want to know who was paying for the potatoes. I'm not interested in whether it's a local firm. Who was actually paying for these potatoes or whatever it is that thousands of people were eating every day?
Yes.
You might have, I mean, you say there are hundreds, which actually surprised me, like there were hundreds of international NGO staff floating around. You actually said there were hundreds of them at one stage. I'm not quite sure what they were doing, because it seems to me that most of the work that you have described so far, with the 12 police officers and the 30 Frontex staff or whatever, the rest of the work appears to have been being done by local police who were acting as volunteers, cooking for thousands of people every day. Now, whether they were cooking them only potatoes every day, but somebody had to buy the potatoes. I mean, I don't suppose that, you know, these potatoes were just being dug out of somebody's back garden and handed in. I mean, that would run out after a while.
No, they have not.
I want to know who's actually financing this operation.
Yes.
Because if I'm talking about fatigue, there is one thing, you know, I might be happy to cook you dinner tonight, and I'll even cook it for you tomorrow and the day after. And I might even be prepared at some stage to actually find the food. But when there's 1,000 of you and there's 1,000 days of you doing this, I can't afford it. However, you know, however well intentioned I am, it's that kind of fatigue which I'm talking about.
Yes, I haven't got there yet. I was answering the question about where the nutrition bars come from. So the nutrition bars come from UNHCR. Hundreds of personnel of humanitarian organizations work in different sectors. I'm not talking, I can discuss more if you want what they are doing. This food, the potatoes, it's actually the subcontracted, so the potatoes is a different story, which is paid. This, which fed the hundreds of people, which relates, if I understand correctly, to your question on fatigue, this all happened with no monetary exchange.
We have to let other people ask questions.
Happened is that the local society offers food. These groups are not being paid, they're not being subcontracted, they're working without any money, and what they accept are offers in kind. And they refuse to get involved in any money exchanges, precisely because they oppose that economy of care which relates to the humanitarian securitization. And yes, they are tired, but they feel they don't have a choice.
Why don't they have accounts? Refugees in the UK having European countries, immediately they're not criminals, they have accounts. And they're entitled about 1,000 basic surviving money to pay for a room and buy their food. I think you got in the wrong direction. I'm sorry, because I think these people are suffering, and they're double suffering. They don't have, they're entitled to the money, to a certain minimum income, plus psychotherapy, and they are lawful immigrants is another matter.
We don't know at this stage if they are lawful or not.
Yes, but they can take immediately if it comes from Syria.
Would you give us your name, please?
Despina Ferentino.
Okay.
I think there is a confusion here. I'm saying they don't take. These are the voluntary activist networks I'm talking about. I'm not talking about refugees.
Yes, I mean hard work. But I think that these people, from the moment it is recognized that it is a civil war in Syria. So immediately the people who are coming out are refugees. So immediately they're entitled to an account and to amounts of money that they should be taking from Europe or from the United Nations. As a refugee, this refugee's amount, they should have a bank account and they should cash their money on a monthly basis. I don't know why this is not happening in Greece. It happens in all European countries.
I can make a comment on that if it helps.
Yes, please.
I assume that to get the account as a refugee, you first have to acquire refugee status. We are talking about here people before they get to that. We are talking about people getting stuck because this personnel doesn't have the capacity to process them quickly. And if they do, what happens? They put them on a boat to go to Piraeus. So what you're suggesting might be relevant for Piraeus, but it's not relevant for Greece. here is the pre-stage where they don't have this status yet, and they have no accounts yet. They might or might not later get later on, but definitely not at that stage.
And in any case, many of the refugees in Greece and Piraeus as well are in transit. I mean, they're aiming to go elsewhere, so they don't want to.
Yeah. Next. And at some point, they may get accounts, but yeah. Not at the stage where that research was done. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Clea, what theoretical assumptions you had about the role of the social media? How is technology implicated in the ethical space of hospitality? That's one question. The other one is related with, again, your notion of hospitality, and in this case of a transient population, whether you have in your notion of hospitality, whether one would take into account the perceptions or the experiences or the wishes of the refugees themselves, the people on the recipient side. In that case, for example, things might be perceived exactly as opposite from what is expected or thought, even with the best meaning kind of hospitality providers. For example, somebody who is eager to get out, perhaps the last thing that they want is to be getting hints that you're here to stay and don't worry, dear, we'll provide for you. Probably the only thing that matters for them is how quickly they get out, even with smugglers. So the psychology of refugees might play a significant role, and their views and their behaviors as well, in the hospitality arena, the regimes of hospitality that you mean. So I wonder whether both theoretically and methodologically the side of the refugees is important in your research or has been important in your research.
Mm.
Yeah,
Just to extend Chrysanthi's comment and add an obvious additional dimension with hospitality, with being hospitable, there are different zones. There's Chios and there's the mainland, and there are different narratives, I presume, in terms of hospitality at those different points. So it goes to what Rebecca was saying about these people are in Chios and then they're in Piraeus and then they're onwards, and presumably there's some kind of loop here, feedback. What people on Chios are hearing, seeing, reading on national media about their circumstances, and vice versa, how the national media is responding to the local situation in Chios. And I just wonder whether you picked up everything sort of a sense of divergence, distance, difference between those narratives as being experienced on the island and then on the mainland, and the connection between the two. So I can't even say the word of hospitality.
Hospitability.
Thank you. That exists at the border, but it also exists on the mainland, and I wonder about the connection between the two.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we take one more if you don't mind? And then have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Gloria Ambiesta, sociologist. Thank you, Miria. I really enjoyed your presentation, and it was very rich, and many, many different things came out of it that I would have wanted to raise. But just a couple of things. One relates to the historicization, or the historicity that Rebecca asked about, and the importance of a kind of collective memory of Greeks about displacement. But I'm not sure whether that collective memory functions in and of itself as a kind of explanation or for us to understand why the Greek people were so hospitable, irrespective of the kind of contradictions and so on involved. Because, for example, migrants in Britain have a collective memory of migration, and yet they voted for Brexit and very anti-migration. You know, so I don't think collective memories of sort of violence or whatever necessarily function. I'm wondering to what extent some of the explanation might come from the fact that these were temporary, that the Greek people knew that these were not going to stay, that the refugees were not going to impinge upon their lives forever. So the transient nature of the phenomenon is important, and the narratives around this transient aspect, and how perhaps, you know, the media or technology and, you know, the very terms and categorizations themselves function to reinforce this idea that, you know, don't worry, they're not going to be here. But that's one thing. The other thing is the notion of hospitability, which I think is an interesting notion, because what it brings into play is the kind of contradictory nature of hospitality in systems of control and systems of violence. And it seems to me here that it might be quite useful perhaps to make a distinction between the kind of hospitability you're talking about as an outcome of social forces, and hospitability as a regime, as a system of control in and of itself. Because to treat hospitability as a regime in a kind of, might end up as a kind of functionalist sort of version, as a mode of control in and of itself, that is linked centrally to the other, to the bordering practices and the other securitization practices. The hospitality, though, might have certain outcomes that might reinforce those things, but that doesn't make it necessarily a regime in the way I understand the regime. I've got lots of other things that I'm interested in, but just those two now. Mm-hmm.
Answer those and all of these, respond to all of these, I think.
I think there's some really big questions here, and I'm trying to make sense of them. And I think you partly touched upon the way I want to answer the questions on hospitality / hospitability. And there might be partly, perhaps, you know, a challenge or a problem for this paper as well. I think there are two different levels of hospitality that we're looking here, and I think that touches upon all three questions. It's the level of an ethics, the moral obligation or the moral engagement with others, and the perhaps, as you know, Derrida invites us to consider that unconditional welcoming of others, and treating others with respect and as equals, making sure that their voices are heard and that we take into account others, newcomers, even if they are strangers to us, trying to understand their biography, their histories, their particularities, and respect them as they come into our land, perhaps our world, our societies. Okay, so there's that bigger, more conceptual level where we're thinking also about hospitability, which is perhaps an attempt to interpret that contradiction that we see. That thus we think that we can think about it as a regime in the same way that we think about, you know, the politics of violence or the politics of control and categorization of human beings. And then there's hospitality, which is the practice, which relates to how people receive, how they let them in their land, give them food, close their doors, let them have a safe passage, and so on. So I think there are these two levels, and now I'll try to kind of untangle them in relation to your specific questions. Chrysanthi, you asked about social media and then about the voice of the refugees. So there were, I think, two different questions, but I think it's actually the same question. So what we saw with digital media is that very contradictory way that they function on the island. What I tried, for example, to highlight in relation to the unidirectional communication from the humanitarian sector is that we have a mobilization, an effective mobilization of technologies that are available to everyone within reason. So we have technologies that are interactive, that can connect all the actors of the border, but actually they're switched off and by to the refugees. So digital communication can be very, could be one of the most effective ways through which the voices of the refugees can be recorded and being part of the story of the border of the or of the Europe that we're writing now. And I think other people are doing work in this area. So Europe that has now received 1 million refugees, do we know what these people think of us or what they want to do here or what kind of, you know, how see them, how they see themselves in Europe? And I think digital media is one of the most effective ways.
So you were thinking about technology as a tool, because you mentioned somewhere performativity. That's why I ask you, theoretically, what is how technology comes into your research? As a tool for to effective for whatever objectives or for an ethical space of behavior, or in a more kind of sneaky way, these technologies do things beyond our intentions and... At the moment, I'm asking which
yes.
of the two.
No, I think
we're
there.
No,
I think these work in both levels. I think on the practice and on the in the practical and the discursive level, or on the ethical level. So if the humanitarian sector does not engage in any interaction, it doesn't give any space for voice for refugees. You know, it organizes its practices in certain ways. But then again, what kind of recognition does it give to those actors? And this relates, I think, to the, you know, the performativity of the insider and the outsider, the other, and the we. Who has the right to speak relates, I think, to who has access practically to the technology. So maybe I hear you. I think it's a bit tangled, but in a way, perhaps we think it's inevitably interconnected, that abstract and that practical level.
We have a bunch more questions.
Oops, okay. Well, they're very difficult questions, sorry. Well, I think it's the same with, again, with hospitality as practice and hospitality and hospitability as a regime, which I think it's something that runs across both Kevin's and Floyd's question. Yes, there's a practice that we feel has consequences. There are practices on the ground which are manifested in different ways that feed into a regime that has further and bigger consequences in relation to ethics. Very quickly, in relation to the loop and the contradictions, mainland and the island, yes, at that moment, that we were there, the people at the border on the island felt that they were so much better than the people in the mainland. And they were the kind of bastion of hospitality. Things have changed, and partly they changed because, as Flo has said, then they thought the newcomers are transient, not anymore.
Okay, we have a cluster of questions here that I'll do this new order I saw them. So one, and then two, and three, so, and then four. So Katerina, Talia, and then so your first one.
Yes, my name is Sergen. I used to be a social anthropology student in LSC. I found that quotation from the activist quite interesting, because it seemed to me as an expression of defeat, actually, and it also seemed to me as an expression, it seemed to me as something that a classic bureaucrat would say. I would want to hear more of that feeling felt by the activists. Like, does defeat turn them into bureaucrats?
You mean this one, yes?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think my question is similar. It's just a quick question on the stance. Oh, sorry, I'm Katerina from a PhD student at the European Institute of Observatory. Regarding the stance of the local activists, So you mentioned that on the one hand they demonstrated humanitarian solidarity, compassion, and empathy to a great extent, but also you mentioned there was a lot of othering based on certain characteristics like physical appearance or gender roles, things like this. So I wasn't clear about whether they were the same people who were feeling both things at the same time, or there were different people feeling both things at the same time, or there were the same people feeling both things at different times.
Thalia Mazioglu, Hellenic Observatory, visiting fellow. I'm working on the notion of democracy, which has something to do with ethics in a way, but for common good. And two things. One, in my sample last year, as I was interviewing new people, there was someone from Lesbos who was a volunteer. And she told me that somehow this experience that she had with the refugees modified also the way that she was seeing democracy, and that she felt that she was more ready to fight for democracy because she felt that it was something that was really sort of menaced in the situations, actually. And also talking about borders and islands, you mentioned the European borders, national borders, but I think the island also, the islands have also something specific, and from other experiences that I have in Kalymus this summer. Because even more than in other parts of Greece, there is a full of local culture. Some of them might be refugees of other generations, but there are also certain specificities that maybe could have something to do with understanding why these people react the way they do, and not people that are in Sweden, and not only just because people are passing by.
Great. We'll take one final question then.
Hi, I'm Zoe Gardner. I'm a PhD student at the European Institute as well. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. And as someone who was in Lesbos at the exact same time that you were in Chios, I definitely recognize that whole not like that it was in Lesbos comment, because it wasn't, I think the attitude on the part of the forces of military securitization at that time was very different. So I wanted to just add a really, really quick point of the previous discussion, which was that under the EU legislative framework for asylum seekers, the Common European Asylum System, the Reception Conditions Directive does stipulate that asylum seekers should be given accommodation and food and subsistence and potentially money and so on. That system has not been functioning in Greece for ever since the Common European Asylum System was put into place, and it certainly was completely overwhelmed by this. So yeah, if the legal frameworks had been happening as this had been implemented as appropriate for the last decade or so, you know, this crisis never should have happened, but it was a failure of what is supposed to happen. My question for you is very much related to my own work, but I wonder whether, probably given the immediacy of the situation you were in, perhaps you didn't see any groups of self-organized refugee communities acting to welcome and to support the new arrivals. And if not, then perhaps you could imagine, might they be a fourth strand within this and somehow overcome some of the issues and contradictions and hierarchies and othering that you've discussed, which affected all the other groups? And what are your thoughts on how what role they could play or potentially could play more now?
Okay. Activists feeling as bureaucrats. Yes, I think this is what makes it very painful to them, that they have taken that role, partly because the bureaucrats in the state or even the humanitarian sector fails. And this is not what they intended to do. Perhaps what they intended more to do originally is more like what you're suggesting about having, you know, those spaces of collaboration and so on. But there's no space for them, and that's why I describe that as a painful position to be. Compassionate and stereotyping. Who are they? Are they different? Some people are different. But I think the important thing, and what we would like to emphasize, is that in some cases it's the same people.
At the same time?
Yes, sometimes the same time. So But at the same time, we are different at different times, depending, you know, at the pressure or at the moment. You know, when the villagers of Ayermione, you know, after hundreds of people leave and they have to spend 2 hours to clean after them, you know, they can get a bit, you know, grumpy. And they return to those stereotypes. Okay, and I think it's very important for us to say we're very respectful to these people, but I think it's very important to say that side of the story, because that's the side of the hospitability is again a response, perhaps also that conceptual response to that unconditional hospitality of Derrida. So we feel that, you know, if hospitality exists, it's not in that pure form that perhaps Derrida invites us to think, but it is in that messy, muddled, politicized and contextualized form. Democracy, I think that's a fascinating comment. I mean, I don't know what to say about that, apart from I would like to hear more about what that person said. Specificity of the islands, yes. Yes, which is historical and geographical, and different islands also, as you mentioned, have very different politics and geographies. Chios is an island that does not depend on tourism, and I think that had a lot to do with the way that refugees were much more welcome than compared to Kos, for example. Self-organized refugees, fourth strand, yes, that relates to voice, that relates to technologies, that relates to the actors of that ordeal taking more control of their fate, and the rest of us respecting and hearing their side of the story. We didn't see it in the island, and unfortunately the growing militarization does not allow that. Does not allow that, because most people who are stuck, and there are a few thousand stuck in the islands, they're in semi or full detention conditions, which are not great.
What about existing refugee communities, so people who've been there, or you know, even if they're not refugees, who came under whatever circumstances, but are from the same communities, the possibility for them to organize, you know, civil society or whatever.
I think we don't really have that in islands. We have a couple of small... Yes, in Athens, I think there's some mobility from some of the existing refugee organizations. But still, it's very small, I think, and very unorganized.
Great. Well, I think we'll have to wrap it up here. But thank you very much for what was a really rich paper, and thank you all for your... also rich comments and questions. Before we thank Miria, I just need to announce our next seminar, 2 weeks from today. Wait, is it 2 weeks? 3 weeks from today. Sorry, 3 weeks today because of the reading week. On November 8th, Dimitri Vaonos from the finance department here at the LSE will be talking about the analytics of the Greek crisis. So same time, same place on the 8th of November. Please join me in thanking Miriam for a wonderful